by the way, this is at a time when a lot of those products and services aren't responsive to the needs and aspirations and interests of their customers. You know, I sometimes tell the story about I've got an aging mom who's pushing 93, and I was outside her building several months ago walking with her old kind of bent aluminum metal walker. You know, a moment later, this young couple walked by with a baby in a baby carriage, and the baby carriage was the most gorgeous thing I'd ever seen in my life. It was kind of titanium, and it had swooping lines, and it was just absolutely beautiful. And what it makes you realize is that people are spending time designing and developing and building and innovating products for what's actually a shrinking portion of the population.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Pop Health Podcast. This is your host, Zach Morgan, and as always, I'm happy to have you with us. Today, I'm excited to share my conversation with Paul Irving, the chairman of the Center of the Future of Aging at the Milken Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank. Someone who's heavily involved in the aging industry, I was excited to get to talk to Paul and discuss some of the main ideas that the Center for the Future of Aging studies. Things like the business potential of such a rapidly growing aging population, and also some newer ideas like purposeful aging and how that's affecting the branding of major corporations and brands like AARP. As always, we really hope you enjoy the episode. We look forward to having you back next time. So, Paul, thanks again for having me in your beautiful offices here in Santa Monica. It's a very nice day. We're surrounded by pictures of lots of the luminaries that have been a part of the Milken Institute. People might recognize the name of the Milken Institute from a previous episode we did with Ariel Burstein. However, for the audience members who might not remember or may not know, can you give us an idea first of the Milken Institute and its objectives?
Sure. So first of all, let me say thanks for having me, and I look forward to a good conversation. The Milken Institute is a fairly far-flung nonprofit. So we have offices in Santa Monica, in Washington, D.C., in Singapore, and in London. And we're engaged in a whole series of activities around public health, around medical research, the kind of expansion of prosperity, particularly in parts of the world that are still developing, education and other areas. So what we do is kind of one piece of that. I used to oversee the broader activity, and now I very much focus on health and healthy aging.
Yeah. How did that mission begin? What was kind of the genesis of the Milken Institute?
So Mike Milken, our chairman, had always been involved philanthropically going way back. He's an ambitious guy in his philanthropy, just the way he was in his primary career. And he's wanted to build a big, successful organization, mission-driven, with measurable and accessible outcomes and accomplishments. And he's attracted a lot of talented people. And we have these very interesting convenings. We do get-togethers around the U.S. and around the world, and we do medical research and communication strategies to try to change hearts and minds.
Yeah, and we'll dive into this a little bit more a little bit later, but some of the people I know, people who are listening can't see, but some of the luminaries who are around the walls, it's not all people from healthcare or
no.
From politics and health leaders. How do you draw in people even from Hollywood or from the sports world or different kind of thought leaders?
So our thesis is that change starts at the top and the bottom, right? It starts among influencers, whether those influencers are social figures and leaders. You know, the Martin Luther Kings of the world who will really change things in incredible ways, or business leaders or policy leaders on the one hand, and we need to also spread the news on a broader basis. So we collect a really interesting, by the way, nonpartisan, right, postpartisan group. We're very mindful of that, a diverse group of people who have different ideas and different thoughts, and we try to get them to mingle together and to come up with new, innovative, transformational ideas and oftentimes to try to affect them, to try to put those to work.
Fantastic. So you mentioned your role as you used to lead the entire institute. Now you chair the Institute on Aging.
The Center for the Future of Aging.
Excuse me.
No problem.
So can you tell the audience a little bit about that center and then its role within the Milken Institute?
Sure. So the Center for the Future of Aging was started a couple of years ago. I can tell you a little story about how we began it. I actually had no personal background in aging and longevity. I came to the Institute in 2011 after a career as a lawyer in private practice. I did corporate work. I ended up running a large national law firm, and I went off to Harvard for a year to teach and study, and I came back. And the notion was that I'd lead the Institute, that I'd become president of the Institute, which is where I started. And literally a day or two after I started my new job at the Institute, the guy who was then running our development group came running into my office and said, "We have a supporter who wants to do a high-impact project on aging." And my response to him was, "Well, I hope you told them that we weren't qualified to do it because we really don't have a subject matter expert in the area." And he said, "Oh, no. I think it'd be a great idea for us to do it." I told him yes. And then he said to me kind of something like, "Well, Paul, you're old. Maybe you can help work on this." So that led to the creation of a data-based ranking system of U.S. metros called Best Cities for Successful Aging. And the more I learned, the more I studied, and the more I engaged with people in the field, the more I realized that this was an area that just was kind of undercovered, under-focused on, and it was something that we needed to spend more time and energy on for the purposes of a better society, stronger businesses, healthier families and communities, and decided a couple of years ago that's where I wanted to invest all my time. So the mission of the center is to enable longer and healthier lives for the benefit of again individuals, families, businesses, and societies. And we convene people to have discussions. We run campaigns. We have a public campaign called the Mayor's Pledge. We've got mayors across the United States to decide to improve their cities for an aging population, and we do research and collaborate with lots of others in the U.S. and around the world.
Sure. So have you kind of seen that anecdote of we don't have a professional on aging, and so maybe that's not for us? As kind of a broader trend, it seems as though maybe the focus on aging has grown over the past couple of years. Do you feel like that's maybe not just within the Institute or the Center for the Future of Aging here?
So there are kind of two big worlds in aging. One big world is the world of services and supports, people who've been working to help older people for decades, and we have to honor their work. They're social workers and psychologists and psychiatrists and geriatricians and planners and others who've been doing this work in many, many ways, kind of under-recognized, under-rewarded, under-compensated, under-supported. And then there's this kind of world of positive aging, of the notion that we have these longer lives and that they present opportunities for ongoing work and for new experience and new relationships and all the rest. What we saw is there weren't enough efforts to kind of connect those two worlds, to realize that on the one hand, aging is an opportunity, that science has done its part by enabling average lifespans that are basically about twice as long as they were 150 years ago or so through advancements in science and sanitation and safety. So on the one hand, a great opportunity, this growing human capital asset of more and more older adults, right, the potential for longer and more involved lives. But on the other hand, to never trivialize the problems and the challenges of health and care and all the other things that need to occur to improve lives for aging people. So long way of saying that we saw this kind of connecting point, the opportunity to bring these two communities together, and that's one of the things that we try to do.
Yeah. Highlighted, especially in a place like Los Angeles or on the West Side, are some of those challenges and
the coming together point that you talk about, yeah, both with housing and with access to healthcare is really highlighted here.
Yeah.
So on that point, so you authored a book released in 2014, The Upside of Aging, How Long Life is Changing the World of Health, Work, Innovation, Policy, and Purpose. And it actually featured essays from different thought leaders throughout aging and health. And it struck a decidedly positive tone, yep, or outlook on aging, which I think sometimes contradicts a lot of the tone of the conversation surrounding aging. Can you explain a little bit about why you had that rosier outlook upon releasing that,
sure,
book?
Sure. I wouldn't say rosebud. I think you're right. It generally had a positive frame. And I think part of that was, again, recognizing the challenges that exist for many, many older people. The notion that if we don't capitalize on this blessing of the advancement, particularly in science, that has enabled longer lives, tackling infectious disease, making improvements in chronic disease, focusing on brain health and all the rest, if we don't figure out ways to enjoy the benefits of that longevity dividend, then we're really, in many ways, missing the boat and missing an opportunity that didn't exist for our forebears, for prior generations. So, you know, you and I are different generations. The prospects are for you to live longer than me. And if you have kids, the prospects are for those kids to potentially live longer than you. And the question is, what will we do with these longer lives? Can we make them productive and engaging and valuable? Can we mentor members of the younger generation? Can we build a better society? If we don't do those things with our longer lives, then what's the point?
Right.
Then, in a sense, science has done its part, but social science has failed.
Right. Now, 4 years on from the release of the book,
right,
are there some glaring differences between then and now that really stick out to you? Maybe a main few things that really have changed over the years, both positively or negatively?
Look, I think it's moving, but it's moving slowly, but it is moving. I sense way more interest in this topic than existed a couple of years ago in media circles, in business, in policy circles. Look, there's a recognition of the importance of aging at a very high level in Asia and Europe, where populations are aging more rapidly than has been the case in the U.S., right, but of course that could all change with less enlightened immigration policies, which have really dampened the effect of population aging in the U.S. But the truth of the matter is that people are realizing this is going to change everything. It's going to change markets. Who should we be focusing on? About a billion people, 60 plus, in the world today. The most conservative estimates are about 2.1 billion at mid-century, 10,000 Americans turning 65 every day. The oldest population being the most rapidly growing population. Millennials having fewer kids than people anticipated would be the case. Not in many places in the world having children at replacement value. So what that means is the world's going to be an older place. And how do we reinvent all institutions to adapt to that older demography? And again, I think the good news is more and more people are thinking about it. Things are changing. Workplaces are changing. Products and services are changing. Policies are changing. They're just not changing rapidly enough.
Right. I think that sounds like kind of what you're already seeing in a place like Japan, where the entire population has been aging and not replaced as quickly with a younger generation. Yeah. And even finding caretakers and different challenges like that have sprung up more unexpectedly.
So Japan, you know, Japan is the canary in the coal mine. It's the developed country with the oldest population in the world. But we should never misunderstand the global phenomenon that's occurring. So it's true, by the way, across China is rapid aging at an incredibly rapid rate. Korea, South Asia, all of Europe, Russia, much of Latin America these days, and of course the U.S. and Canada. So this is a global phenomenon. And guess what? In decades to come, population aging will occur relatively rapidly in India and in Africa, which of course is going to be the largest continent in the world in the next millennium. So you know, cultures have changed. This is, by the way, not just a product of increasing longevity. It's a product of low birth rates.
Sure.
As women have advanced in the world, thankfully, as women have had more opportunity for work and for capital access and for freedom, one of the net effects of that has been women having fewer children, and that's very likely to continue.
Yeah. I think on this podcast, we talk a lot about some of the population health challenges just in general, but also with aging in some of the social constructs that you have touched on a little bit here. But I actually want to talk about a study that you recently released here. It was called Turning Silver into Gold, The Business of Aging. First of all, can you tell the audience a little bit about that report and some of the findings that were that were released there?
Sure. So look, the purpose, all the things we do are driven by an effort to achieve outcomes. We're not interested in writing monographs that sit on an academic shelf someplace. We're trying to change hearts and minds and policies and practices and to try to get people moving. So our case basically is that any business, particularly larger businesses that aren't focusing on population aging, are missing the boat, and frankly, probably not serving all of their stakeholders, their shareholders, their employees, their customers, the communities they serve. It's almost inevitable that their businesses will change, whether they like it or not, as a result of an aging population. And what we're saying is, there's a great opportunity to capitalize on this change and to capitalize on it quickly. Just to give you a couple data points, the longevity economy in the United States, that is the economy that reflects product, services, and related economic activity in the U.S. For those 50 plus, is about $7.6 trillion. The would be the third largest economy in the world. Globally, the market, the current market for those about 60 plus is about 20 trillion. And by the way, this is at a time when a lot of those products and services aren't responsive to the needs and aspirations and interests of their customers. You know, I sometimes tell the story about I've got an aging mom who's pushing 93, who thankfully is still with us, and I was outside her building several months ago, walking with her old kind of bent, she kind of likes it, but aluminum metal walker. You know what those metal walkers look like, you can imagine it. And so we're out standing in front of her building, and you know, a moment later, this very attractive young couple, probably, you know, kind of later stage millennials, walk by with a baby in a baby carriage, and the baby carriage was the most gorgeous thing I had ever seen in my life. It was kind of titanium, and it had swooping lines, and it was just absolutely beautiful. And what it makes you realize is that people are spending time designing and developing and building and innovating products for what's actually a shrinking portion of the population, and ignoring the potential to create great new things that this larger audience can benefit from, and that larger audience seeks. So our point in the report is to really say two things. One, focus on product development for older adults, and integrate older adults in that thought process. Two, it's that your workforce is going to change. Your workforce is going to be older. So how can you benefit from the potential of intergenerational workforces, from intergenerational mentorship, and kind of combining the skills of young people and the experience and wisdom of older people for better results? Yeah. So that's what that report's about.
It seems like a different approach than most research that you see on the topic of aging, where it's just facts and statistics about how quickly the population is aging, and we are short resources here, or different kind of warning signs that it seems comes out quite often. Is that, and so it's actually focused on trying to engage business leaders and actually trying to draw them or meet them kind of where they're at. Yeah. Is that the intention? Is that, do you hope to spark a different dialogue with a report like that?
Look, you know, the the reality is population aging is at the point, at this point, is inevitable.
Yeah.
So it's very much, you know, I sometimes do the climate change analogy. It is going to happen. The right. population is going to be older. So the question is, will institutions across society, not just businesses, but policy institutions, educational institutions, communities, et cetera, cities, will they all adapt to this different group of human beings that are going to be intersecting with these institutions in years to come? So the answer is, you can react or not.
Right.
Our theory is look at reality and react. And by the way, not only react, but capitalize on it. Take advantage of what is a great opportunity, not just for your own benefit, not just for the benefit of business, but very much for the benefit of these older adults who seek responsive products and services to meet their changing needs. You know, whether it's home design, you know, a door that's designed for a 25-year-old might not be able to fit a wheelchair, but a door that's designed for a wheelchair can almost always fit a 25-year-old.
Right.
Right. So just thinking about that, integrating population aging, integrating this prospect for increasing longevity into your planning, it's just smart.
Yeah.
You know, you remember the Robert Frost poem about two roads diverge.
Right.
Either we can kind of go down the same road that we've been going down, which is a population that is underserved, that is not as healthy as it should be and could be, that doesn't have the right kinds of access and nutrition, that's subject to ageist norms. Or what we can do is change our attitudes and enable people to work longer, which they aspire to do, and encourage and promote public health so that we compress mortality and morbidity, those kinds of things. And if we do what's smart, what makes sense, and what's reflective of the reality of changing demography, we'll not only enable people to have better lives, but we'll create a stronger, healthier, and freaking more economically viable society.
Yeah. On the other side of that, you touched on this a little bit. What kind of positive effects do those kinds of changes or those kinds of initiatives have on things like purposeful aging, that really in and of itself can be a huge health boon for that population?
Sure. Well, we've done a report on purposeful right. aging that talked not just about kind of the aspirational soft aspects of it, but the impacts both for older adults who experience these positive characteristics in their lives, and frankly for the beneficiaries of their work. So there's really compelling evidence that things like volunteering are not just good for the beneficiaries of that volunteering, but are actually good for the health of the volunteers. The people who see their aging in positive ways, one of our advisors, Becca Levy, who's a professor at Yale, has done this really interesting research on the impact of image on aging, how one feels about their own aging. You're looking at me, and you see I've got a bald head, and I've got crow's feet these days, and I feel just fine about it. I can't run as fast as I used to or jump as high as I used to, but I'm probably smarter than I was when I was 30. And the point is embracing this notion that aging is not necessarily just decline,
right.
just deterioration, just removal and disengagement. It can also be a time of new excitement, new relationships, new opportunities, potentially the opportunity to find more purpose in this shorter period you have ahead than you did in this longer period you had behind. That's right. I think that should be the aspiration for all of us,
right.
for ourselves and for our parents and for our grandparents, to experience rich and satisfying and engaging lives as they move forward. Again, obviously with the recognition that some can't, right? The disease and decline do impact the ability of many people to realize those possibilities. But all these things are interrelated. Right. I mean, you know, health and a sense of purpose and ongoing opportunity for work and new relationships to mitigate the effects of isolation and loneliness. And all these kinds of things are related in new ways to think about how we age.
Right.
We need to have these conversations. you know, a friend of mine, Ellen Goodman, I was on the phone with her this morning, Pulitzer Prize winning writer, started something called the Conversation Project. And it's this wonderful organization that focuses on conversations, open family conversations about death. And I've said to Ellen several times in the past, you know, you've come up with this great mechanism for encouraging people to have honest and open conversations about their own death and kind of what they want, how they want to control their lives at the end. But what we really haven't done yet is figure out a way to have conversations about getting old,
right,
and what the best way is to do that. And, you know, we need to do that with our parents and our kids and our friends and be much more open about it, because very honestly, I mean, aging is the common denominator in a society that's so fractured now across politics and race and gender and so many other things. You know, aging is the thing we all have in common if we're lucky.
Right.
So.
Right. I mean, you can just look at the revamped AARP a marketing and outreach campaign over the past year or two to see that message is resonating with some of the largest players in the aging space.
It sure is. It's no longer retired persons. Now it's real possibilities and a lot of other very positive things. And
right.
Joanne Jenkins, who's the CEO, is a good friend of ours and on our advisory board. And, you know, Joanne is interested in promoting this notion. By the way, it's AARP's 60th anniversary this year. It's wow. it's this notion that aging is not just a time of decline. It's a time of great possibilities for maybe, you know, what could be the most satisfying an accomplished time of one's life.
Right. I do want to take a little bit, as we do on this podcast, when we get to talk to distinguished guests and people who have had a career, an exciting and interesting career, to ask you a few questions about your thoughts on leadership and kind of how you got here and how that relates to your job here today. One thing we always like to ask is, besides your own, if you're ever asked, what is a book or some books that you typically recommend to people?
Boy, you know, I've read a lot of leadership books. You know, the books like Good to Great and Bill George's book. You know, Bill used to run Medtronic and is now on faculty at Harvard Medical School, and there are a lot of others. You know, I think many of them have common themes in bravery and flexibility and adaptability, clarity of purpose, honesty, you know. And those are, again, interestingly, I think, attributes that are often enhanced by age. You know, the inclination to be more direct, more kind of comfort in your own skin, authenticity. You know, I've seen so many different leaders, and I've, you know, both in my prior life represented so many prior different leaders, and in my current life interact with leaders in academia and policy and business and other things. They're very different people. They bring different skills to the table. There's no magic formula. Obviously, you know, brains is important and commitment is important. We've all heard the adage that things are, you know, 90% perspiration and 10% inspiration, or maybe it's even less.
Yeah.
You know, I think kind of just sticking to it makes a big difference.
Sure.
You know, there are a lot of people who have bumps in their lives. In my old life, I will tell you this. In my old life, I was the hiring partner in my law firm before I became the CEO of the firm. And we kind of changed our recruiting approach a little bit. We had tended to recruit people from Ivy League schools who had oftentimes had ideal lives, who had been, you know, their high school valedictorians and had been successful athletes and had done what and grown up in relatively affluent families. And they were wonderful. They were smart and talented and had been exposed to the world in many, many ways, but they were also oftentimes somewhat fragile because they had never experienced getting beaten up, kicked around, failing. And I concluded at a certain point that the kind of person we really wanted to hire was the person who graduated, first in their law school class, but that was after having driven a cab for 2 or 3 years,
right,
or working on a dock for a couple of years, being in the military or something else, where you get jostled around a bit. So I think, you know, resiliency is a really, really important characteristic of leadership.
Yeah. What about, what is maybe one of the best pieces of advice that you've ever gotten, or pieces of advice that you've held on to throughout your career?
Boy, I don't know. You know, sometimes people ask me how I ended up coming to this, as opposed to just staying in my law practice for the rest of my life. And I think at the end of the day, we're all products of our childhood. We're products of messages that we get from our parents. And I got a very clear message when I was a kid that an aspiration for all of us is that we should leave the world a better place than we found it. I think there's not enough emphasis on that today in our political leadership and in many other places in our society. So in my own little way, whether I'll be successful or not, who knows, but at least it's worth an effort to try to do something that's contributing and maybe contributing in a different way than what I did previously in life. So, you know, I credit my folks.
Excellent. And so actually, as I kind of wrap up here, the last two things that I just kind of want to pick your brain on before we finish up here are somewhat related to that in both different ways. You are associated with the USC School of Gerontology, which I understand to be one of the oldest, if not the oldest, definitely one of the most prominent schools of gerontology.
It's actually the only.
The only.
Yeah, there the only. There are gerontology programs in medical schools, public policy schools, schools of public health in various and sundry places across the U.S. and the world. But the USC Davis School of Gerontology is genuinely the only one in a building built by the small contributions of early AARP members. So it's quite an exceptional place. Multidisciplinary faculty, bioscientists, demographers, social scientists, and various others.
So my question is, because in your role here, whether it was your role over the Milken Institute as a whole or over the center now, how do you approach educating students versus educating professionals? Is there a difference to your approach when working with those two groups?
Yeah, I mean, look, the good news is that, you know, being a millennial parent, you know, students who are not your children tend to listen to you. That's a good characteristic. No, I mean, I think what it makes me recognize is this extraordinary and natural connection between older people and younger people, and the complement in their approaches and skills. You know, young people have such energy, think so creatively, they're risk takers by nature. They think out of the box, and they question why convention makes sense. And older people bring the reality of getting stuff done, right? Of taking an idea and actually transforming it into action, of navigating complex environments, right, of seeing across sectors. So this is one of the reasons why I think there's such a beautiful connection between older people and younger people, because the characteristics of youth and the characteristics of age really, I think, lead to, when joined, lead to better outcomes. So I learn from students, and I learn from my peer colleagues, and I try to bring those learnings to both audiences.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so then, just kind of running off of that, you know, your goal here, like you said, with the study that you've recently released, it's not just to put research out into the world, it's to affect change. You had mentioned political turmoil at different points. It happens quite often. We seem to be in a particularly turbulent time for healthcare,
I'd say,
in America, right? Yeah. As a nonpartisan group whose work is to research and then affect what you see to be positive change, how do you manage long-term growth and effects throughout changes of administration or changes of politicians or changes of ideologies?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I think you start with a premise that there are reasonable people who have different political principles, and there are opportunities to get those reasonable people to sit together, to think together, and to seek solutions. You have to remember that politics in the U.S. changes by 2, 3, 4, 5% if you look at the last several elections. So, right. So there are people on the fringes who, for some reason, have the attitudes they have, and they are likely not the people who are going to actually shift policy and practice. It's more the people in the middle. I think you have to believe in certain things. You have to believe in science, which we do. You have to believe in evidence, which we do. For people who deny science and deny evidence, there's not a lot of hope in bringing them along. I think you have to fundamentally believe that changes in policy and changes in business practice can improve lives. We believe both. So we believe that the government has a really important role, and we believe that the private sector has a really important role, and that both of them can do things to improve lives. And we always try to have bipartisan representation in every room, in every meeting we call, in every room we organize. Now, again, I will say I think that there are people that are kind of outside the norm these days that are difficult to reach, and I don't think that we're any more successful in reaching them than many others are, but we've seen, you know, for example, advocacy for at the Milken Institute, we are not lobbyists, but we do inform and educate. So advocacy for money for medical research, for example, where D's and R's have gotten together, collaborated, and come up with effective solutions just in the last couple of years. We believe that there are ways that we can improve the system of public reimbursement and private insurance to, for example, do more to support prevention and wellness, which is something around 5% of the federal health budget, something that we know has to be done to do more to stop smoking, to do more to address an obesity pandemic in the United States. It's led to record levels of type 2 diabetes, to tackle opioid abuse and gun violence and suicide and things like that, which, by the way, are impeding increasing longevity in many portions of our population. So we're optimists, and we think that there's hope to bring people who are serious and seek solutions and believe in institutions together to affect change. And we're going to continue to work on that basis until we fail or get dragged out kicking and screaming.
Right.
So that's what we'll do.
And like you said, there's the reality that everybody gets old despite the political party. So
that's exactly right. You know, it's really interesting when I speak to groups, and I do all the time now, and I actually go out of my way not just to spend time with, you know, with elites in policy and business, but to spend time in you know, in health facilities, and spend time in senior centers and communities and things like that, talking to people with very different ideas, you know, faith-based institutions, et cetera. And you really do find kind of an unbelievable opportunity for common ground around this topic. It is the shared condition. The challenges in caregiving are, you know, cross all boundaries, rich and poor, black and white, Republican and Democrat, all of us end up as caregivers in one way or another for children and parents and all the rest. All of us deal with the challenges of disease. All of us will die, and so that, I think, creates a basis for solutions that may not exist with some other challenges that we face in our society.
Right. Well, Thank you so much for sitting down with me. Sure. Your insight has been really wonderful, and I hope everybody enjoyed.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.